soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion, sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well just follow me.
Thank you. Welcome to Conscious Choices Sacred Healings with Tony, Rev, and Spirit Dancer. And we have a wonderful guest today by the name of Richard Gabriel, who we're going to introduce in just a minute. But I want to thank everybody for joining us. We are on These Changing Times with Z Radio.ning.com. And many times we talk about Blueprints of Cosmic Consciousness, the book that Tony wrote, part 1 and 2, and hopefully part 3 will be out soon. www.awakeconsciousawareness.com is where you can get the book. And Rav, why don't you say hi, and then we're going to introduce Richard and talk to him a little bit and see what's going on with him. Rav, you there?
Yes, hello. My computer is being a little bit slow today. Sorry about that. I am doing good. It is sunny, and my chickens are obviously happy because you could hear them going before. And, yeah, everything's going pretty good.
Awesome. Wow. And Richard, how are you?
Yes, I'm very happy, and I'm on standby here, and I'm ready to cut in whenever the opportunity presents or the need arises.
Well, why don't you go ahead and tell us what you do, Richard, and a little about yourself, and then when Tony joins us, he can step right in.
Okay, then. Yes, I can see from the screen that Tony is desperately trying to join in. I think he may be with us now, in fact.
Yes, indeed. Okay. Thank you, Richard.
Okay, wonderful. Greetings once again. Okay, I'll just rabbit away for a little bit. I tend to be like somebody... it's on a constant ramble when the button's pushed, so if anybody wants to give me a nudge at any time, feel free.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm here talking to you on my own, but I'm not alone, because Judith, my twin flame, who is in Pittsburgh, is with me in spirit at the moment. She is attending to the 4th of July celebrations over there, and she's attending to her folks, her parents, and other members of the family. She's organized something for them all, and she's dealing with them, but I can tell you, and I can tell from the signals, I'm actually getting signals that we pass between each other, that her thoughts on a different level are with me and all of us here now. To everyone who may be listening, I always count on at least one person out there who's listening, so I'll assume that. My story really goes back to earliest memories. All through childhood, it was almost like wearing two hats. My mundane life was one hat, and the spiritual life was as prominent as my mundane life, and that took me on a spiritual supernormal journey throughout my life to memories that go back to when I was just, you know, hours to days beyond birth. I've been privileged to enjoy supernormal experiences of all the classic kinds throughout my life, and that led, if you like, to a spiritual journey of exploration to understand in this life, to regain the memory of how it all fitted together and what it was all meant to lead to for me in this life. Culminated about 30 years ago when I was working in Germany. I had another worldly experience to sort of cap them all, which I call my event. And in that experience, I feel almost like I'm like deja vu when I describe it this way, because I've really not found any better way to describe this. On that occasion, it was very much like the movie Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where he's got a memory that's implanted to his brain, his own memory is suppressed, and he has a total recall. His memory is given back to him. Well, on that night, that occasion, without all the detail, it can be read about on the site or in the new book that we've just published, I can say that I had a memory recall myself, but it was my own memory. But in the time, in the day and the night and the week following, where I feigned illness from work to sort of come to terms with it, I had to test it against my own experience. It was like gradually feeding into it and understanding it, even though it was my own memory. And at the end of it all, I was satisfied, exhausted and satisfied, that I'd been given back a true memory of how matter functions up to the illusionary barrier of quantum and beyond into dimensions beyond physical. And I guess from that point on, I often say also that understanding the strategy of how everything works is one thing, but it's quite another thing to come to terms with the infinite tactics of that in operation. And that takes you to your own life. I may have understood how it all fitted together, but in the way that I applied it myself, in my own life, I was still very much lacking. And it took many, many years before it all finally dropped into place. And that was one day before I met again in this life, Judith. I remember quite clearly at the time, laughing out loud, saying to my minders on the other level, "Hey guys, you know, I would have thought you'd have given me a bit of a breather and just let me have a bit of a quiet time for a while. You know, it's taken to this time to get this far. You know, you must really want me to go for something here." And I just knew when I first spoke to Judith, that she was the twin flame that I'd been mistakenly thinking that I'd found elsewhere in years previously. So Judith and I, we share the same outlook, the same thoughts, the same everything, the same. And we both realized that the out-of-body experiences and other things that we had were driving us to one place, and that was Egypt. Had interest in the Orient in the past, in Tibet and other esoteric places, but Egypt was the place that we were absolutely driven to go to. And to cut an awful long story short, over the last 10, 12 years, Judith and I have been back there innumerable times, working below the radar, compulsively drawn to get underground, but many out-of-body experiences which we've cross-validated to each other. We don't take anything for granted between each other. We test everything against our own experience and against each other. If we both have experiences, then we cross-reference with notes and so on, and we're quite vigilant with each other in order to test whether if I was taken somewhere or shown somewhere, that she too had something to say about that same place, that she would have been taken also. And that has happened in particular to do with the Great Pyramid and deep, deep, deep underground beneath the area of the Great Pyramid. That journey has taken us through so many, I've got to use the words, it's a bit of a cliche, I know, but supernormal adventures on, around, in, under the Giza Plateau and the village at Giza, and out in the Western Desert with our wonderful hosts, the Coptic monks, in their cave monastery out there. And it has led us to go deep underground of NC2, Northcliff 2, the cave system, first explored back in 1817 by Salt and, Henry Salt and Giovanni Caviglia, who wrote about the system, but their notes were sort of lost to posterity until fairly recently when they were republished, and researcher Andrew Collins and his colleagues came across them and did some very good astute detective work to actually relocate the crack in the back of the particular cave in the north of the plateau that led into this underground system. And there was a huge public debacle with Zai Hawass before he was discredited and deposed, where the whole system was denied. But we've been in there many times. We've always been guided to get in there, despite the barred entrance that prevents anyone from getting in there, but we've managed to get in. I've been in there alone many, many hours on my own, and made some startling discoveries in there. Now, I suppose if I start last first, is the fact that around 350 foot deep, the way that's described by Salt and Caviglia, it's blocked. There's a tube tunnel there about 4 feet in diameter, rough cut, forced tunnel. But I've been able to bring evidence out which categorically shows that that tunnel wasn't blocked from the top end, the end that you normally would come in through the system. It was blocked from the bottom end. So the understanding from that is that the system has been breached from below. And on a website, very, very long and detailed website article that I've published, I give a proposition as to where other entrances could be, that they have gained entry the authorities. When I say they, I mean higher authorities, mundane authorities, have gained entry to block that audit trail down into the deep underground, as they've tried to do with every other way. Yes, it's the Cave of the Birds, by the way. NC2 is the Cave of the Birds, sort of colloquially named. But that's the tomb itself. I think Cave of the Birds is a misnomer for the actual system itself, which I'll come on to in just a moment and tell you why. So first thing is that the deeper exploration is blocked. It has been purposefully blocked in very recent times, and we've got the evidence to categorically prove that. We also have the evidence to categorically prove that when Zayawas put his team of expert excavators in there just before all the controversy, they raked the system. They raked the guts out of it. We believe a very significant sarcophagus was taken from the chambers, the first level chambers from the main tomb, the entrance tomb, the actual tomb of the birds. Many other, in fact, anything that wasn't nailed down of any significance was taken, it was gone. They raped it. And of course, it was always put out that he put the iron grill across the door. Oops, are we still there? Yes. Sorry, I've just picked up on something here. One moment. Okay, I'll just carry on a second. We picked up the fact that iron grill was put on the door, in truth, not to keep people out who might go in and do something disruptive in the cave system. In other words, it wasn't put on there to protect it against people coming in. It was put on there to stop people getting in there and see, to find out that it had been surreptitiously raped. It was to hide the evidence of what they'd done to it. Further things that we found in there, significant things, was that the whole place is absolutely steeped in history. But OBEs in there were met people, non-humanoid people, or humanoid but not human people in there, and have been taken deep down into the system. There's four locations in there that we know of that wage anything on, that we know specifically at this point here, at that point there, at that point there, within the whole system. Dig here, dig there, go there, excavate here, and it will lead to lower chambers, further lower chambers. The other thing that we found was when you go into the system, the actual cave system itself, you first of all go into a vast reception chamber, and that reception chamber is joined to a second reception chamber. When you step into it and dodge the flying bats, the ones that are left and haven't been scared out of there, you find that it's split into two levels across its width, about 40-foot width. And at the on the higher part, before it drops down several feet to the lower part, leading into the second chamber, there is a huge, huge flat slab of stone. It isn't complete. It's been broken, but it's still huge. And it's raised off the ground on two elevated stones, like trestles that elevate it. On the other side of that, leading down to the lower part, a throne in stone has been hewn out of the stone. Now, that has wings like a breakfast chair, a morning chair, like an old-fashioned hotel chair. But those wings in stone, they lead at the front edges. There's two heads carved, two animal heads carved at the front. I've got these pictures on site. Anybody can follow up everything that I've said and look for themselves. And then you go across rubble at the bottom, substantial stones and rubble that leads through into the second chamber, which is strewn with rubble. Now, the thing to think about is that from the lower chambers, if I orientate everybody, when you step through the door of the tomb, right and left of you, just a little way forward, there are steps leading down. Now, on the left-hand steps, as you go down through them, that leads to two chambers. On the right-hand steps, as you go down, on the left of them, it leads to two chambers. And on the right, there are four chambers. And these chambers are huge. To anybody listening, I'll give you the site reference in just a moment. What we found was that these chambers, each side, from the steps down underneath the main tomb, There's a sort of quasi corridor that joins them on the left hand side. On the right hand side, there is an actual stone corridor which you walk along to find the entrances into each of these chambers, four on the left, two on the left, four on the right. Now, in the that corridor significantly curves round to the right a little bit. Now just bear that in mind a moment. Now, if you go into the third chamber on the right, which is marked G on our list, and I will give you the site in a moment, and in the second chamber. The second chamber is where there was a huge sarcophagus with a big crocodilian head fashioned on it. That was gone. And that had been screened by a thin plaster stone wall, which was demolished and strewn in a line of rubble across the floor of the chamber. All these chambers, incidentally, need a fully excavate, and they're full of sand, windblown sand over centuries. But up at the ceiling level, at the back of both of those chambers, there are holes. And those holes lead into very rough rock, very narrow, rough rock caves, or tunnel caves. Now, those tunnel caves line up with the second reception chamber up above that leads into the tunnel system. The other thing is that the corridor which sweeps round to the right from the schematic that I did of the system with Judith, it lines up with the continuing tunnel from the reception chamber up above into the deeper system, and it also stops roughly, I think, underneath where that stone throne is in the first reception chamber. And what it tells me is that this whole thing was incredibly significant at one time, a long time ago, and it was all interconnected also to the chambers that have still got to be excavated to below, deeper. That's without thinking about the tube tunnel, Salton Caviglia, that goes deeper on into the plateau and joins up with a huge network of tunnels that we already know about further on into the plateau. But the most significant thing of all was that when I got home with Judith, we started going through the pictures, hundreds to thousands of pictures. And I became obsessed, you know, I was examining these and looking at them. They were high definition pictures. And most of them had been taken in complete darkness. I mean, if you could imagine having your head in a coal bucket with the lights out, that's about as absorbing as the light is in there. It's very dangerous, I guess, because there are a lot of poisonous insects in there. And although I have to add that we at no time felt any danger or fear or anything. We felt very, very comfortable. We felt the change in vibration, most certainly. We felt it go over us, spirit wind go over us all the time in there. And the photographs contain masses of the most incredible orbs of different colors right through the color spectrum. But in looking at the photographs that were captured high definition by flash, I was playing around with the contrast and the color filtration and other controls. And suddenly I turned my controls on something, filtered it to show it in green hue. And wham, bam, there was a face staring back at me. I thought, what the hell is this? And I played with it and I thought, this is for real. So it immediately led me to start examining the other photographs in the same way. Now, doing each photograph, it takes forever. It takes ages to do it because these weren't posed photographs. These are incidental photographs of the whole system. But what I found, again, cutting an awful long story short, is that the entire system is absolutely filled with images. And those images are single images, groups of images, tableaus, murals. There are images of human faces that have got a sort of Peruvian look about them or North American, Native American look about them. There are non-humanoid. There are humanoid with animal heads in most cases. On one wall, we picked up what looked like perfect representation of a spacecraft in flight. On another wall, we picked up what looked like suited spacemen. And on and on. Now, those themselves had some further significance because by putting more and more analysis into these pictures, we found that if you change the focal depth that you were looking at by zooming in, zooming out, and playing around with the filtrations and so on, you could expose on the screen a complicated picture with lots of images. You change the focal depth, play with it again, the first picture, of course, was knocked out. But another picture would come into play. And I found, quite by accident, where I looked at a picture upside down. I didn't realize I got it upside down because it was just a wall section. And lo and behold, it showed another picture in a different inversion. And I've tested that against other pictures and it does the same. Now on the screen, many of these pictures, they come out looking as if they're holographs, looking holographic. And the one thing is perfectly, patently obvious to me and to Judith is that we, in our opinion, that these, there's no way these were put on with a brush and some pigment. They were applied by a method that we don't understand. Now, since then, I've applied the same methods to the Great Pyramid, okay, to the Solar Cross, to, you know, Judith's thrown in a few as well. Everywhere where I've applied it to, where there are ancient surfaces that were more protected, it has shown up these walls of record. They're everywhere. And I would speculate that the authorities at that higher level, they know perfectly well about these, and it's probably the reason why cameras have been banned in so many places, in case some zoik like me with some lady at their side stumbles across what they're really hiding. I know that Tony knows a bunch about this sort of stuff as well. So maybe just to give a pause and for me to allow the steam to abate on my tongue, I'll let Tony just grab a moment and I'll type in for you so you can give out the email address in the meantime, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Some pretty detailed information there, Richard, and there's a lot of different areas I'd sort of like to touch on. But one of the most obvious things to anybody that should be listening is, you know, number one, they're hiding information deliberately. And, you know, where we go into in the book is anti-gravity as well as free energy. I mean, when they initially opened the pyramids, they actually smashed up lights that had been in there for, you know, a heck of a long time just to hide the technology of, you know, all of these things one by one. And it's just, you know, it's on a massive scale, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's no shadow of a doubt about that. I mean, other experiments as well that we've done along the way. I mean, I just touch on that in particular, but, you know, we've been involved in hairy stuff. You know, I've had a gun to my head in the middle of the night when I was caught on the plateau. It had all been arranged and sort of officially put in place, but somebody who wasn't in the know stumbled across me, and I found myself going through a very, very difficult few minutes and a little bit more, wondering if he was going to pull the trigger. And I had his pistol at my temple, and I was in no doubt that it could have gone one way or the other. When we were up in the Great Pyramid itself doing the entombment experiment, I mean, again, I'll just touch base on it. I deal with it much more in the book. Just to mention, incidentally, I salute your book, Tony, but also to say that I've just finished with Judith our book, and it's just gone on sale now, Echoes from the Chamber. And I'm sure before the end here, we'll be able to give out a contact. I was just halfway through typing the address in there. I'll complete it in a moment. But back to the Great Pyramid. For what it's worth, I mean, I noticed from when I was a kid, I could create this sort of nasal tone, this entombment sound, and just out of silliness, whatever, you know, when you go to a public toilet or something where it's all tiles and it echoes. Well, I don't know how the first time ever, but I found when I did this sound, I could do it very quietly, and suddenly there was an harmonic fallback of the resonance, and it would get volumetrically, it would become louder and louder and louder and louder. It was hilarious, you know, and it was a party piece, you know, because nobody knew who was doing it or anything. You didn't show, you weren't standing there as if you were behind a microphone delivering an opera. You know, you could sort of quietly do it and it happened. And it was just, it's always just been a party piece. That was until the first time ever visiting the King's Chamber, because I did it in there and I subsequently found that I can hit the frequencies that are the exact frequency range within the chamber. And of course it set it off like crazy. It just went off, I mean, to the point of almost bursting drums. Returned there anyway. And by then, I mean, from all of our experiences, gathered tons and tons of understanding between us. Judith's my anchor in all of this, you know. If ever something went, she would pull me back out. You know, she is my absolute protector, anchor in all of this. She saved us from God knows how many hairy situations. She just intuitively knows what to do. I told Tony earlier, I mean, I, again, make it whimsical, but and she'll speak for herself, but... she has the ability to almost unzip people's heads and shove her arm down inside and pull out whatever's lurking in there and not supposed to come out. But up in the chamber, she stopped a guy. We were in there and decided that we're going to go for it, because I understand now that the entombment, by being able to set the resonance going in there, it is possible to consciously induce an out-of-body experience. And I believe a lot of information in order to get to the things, get to the entrances, to know how to go about things, in order to access stuff that has been laid down by our predecessors, that will be found out of body. The way to that will be found out of body. So anyway, we were up in there, and there was a guy there, a story on its own, but Judith managed to keep a guy from interrupting me. I went in the coffer. It was all set up, the whole experiment, started off, and I felt the sensation was quite different from inducing out of body at home. It was as if the cells in my body were starting to crystallize, and then like a wave, it was creeping up through my body. Well, we were interrupted because the entombment that I was just setting off at the time was the whole chamber was going off to the extent that it was being heard outside the pyramid. And the guards down below, I mean, they were white crazy, because and the announcer was that I was coming back early to the plateau, and Judith sort of pulled me out from it, and it was unpleasant having to be pulled out of it. But the guards were there with damned rifles in our faces and had us out of there. So that's another aspect to it. And I mean, I keep saying back, read the book or read the site, and you'll see all of this stuff in glorious detail. Okay, so. You know, again, I'll call a stopping point there. I could go on forever on all sorts. Like I said, I'm a motor mouth when I get going, because I'm very passionate about it all. I'm going to turn it over again. Tony or Ravina, Rav, if you want to come in, please do. Please do.
Yeah, again, it's all about harmonics, isn't it? This is why the pyramids were set at the angles that they were set up at. And it harnesses the resonant frequencies of the cosmos, basically. And also in that I would actually, I'm just taking a stab in the dark, but I would guess that chamber, it might be something to do with the preparations, or the seven preparations that you do before you go into the actual pyramid. Again, if you look at the Book of the Dead, it will give you seven different balancing things that you need to do before you actually enter into the pyramid. And what happens when you get in there is a whole different subject. But yeah, what's your opinions on that one, Richard?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it. I think when you've been playing around with these thoughts as a part of your life, and it is almost like it's like flicking a switch. I mean, 1 minute I'm dealing with somebody who's fallen over here and I have to pick them from the ground or something. And the next minute I get a call out of the blue from somebody who's never spoken to me before, or who just wants to talk to me about something I didn't realize. Or I get a ping in my cheek, a signal from Judith, and I wait for the phone and she calls. You know, we're able to sort of telepath signals to each other. And you immediately go to alpha. You go to another level. It's just an automatic thing. Bing, you go to it. And you have to get into that vibrationary level. It's a preparation that you subconsciously start putting yourself through. If you're approaching a situation or an area or anything at all where that connection to the power of spirit or the power of those higher light levels of light is required. Okay, so I totally concur with what you're saying, Tony. It is necessary, and of course the ancients knew. Incidentally, I would propose this also, and again, this is just from stuff that I've been given from MinderSource, and that is that back in those days of enlightenment and off-planet guided civilization, I firmly believe that, quite apart from the Great Pyramid itself, that they built what we would colloquially call temples, call them what you will. I'm sure that they built their own centers in different places, just like we've got our health spas. I'm sure that they had their own places built where people could go, adepts, people who were being trained to it, could go to, that also contains the correct resonances within them to enhance the surrounding properties to enable conscious out-of-body experiences. And, you know, these sites are probably all over the world. And there's one or two that we suspect already.
Oh, yeah, they are all over the world. If you just type into a Google search engine, pyramids in China, you'll get quite enough pyramids over there. But this is the point. The whole planet was surrounded, or is surrounded, with pyramids facing to different star systems at different frequencies, tuned in different ways, and all for different reasons. Some of the jobs that the pyramid used to do, there are many, many, many things it used to do, but ultimately, it all works from, like we say, the cosmic energies of the solar system. And, you know, it used to do everything from imbue water to generate power to help the person reach enlightenment and many other things.
Yes, quite so. You know, there's a place that I've been shown many times, put a tag name to it, I call it Home Planet. It's in the Pleiades, or the Pleiades system. Seen it many times in different experiences, but if I describe the place, it comprises on a grand scale pyramidal structures, but they're vast, they're huge, they're miles high, because the sides aren't rocky and solid like ours. I describe them as being polarized. It's like looking at the side of a soap bubble with all the colors swirling and everything, like polarized light.
Absolutely.
Exceedingly beautiful. And on a scale that boggles the imagination, if one thinks the Great Pyramid or the Chinese pyramids big, then, you know, what these appeared to are, you know, they're massive compared to them. So, yes, I think the pyramid form is... In terms of geometry and its effect interacting with Earth energies, cosmic energies, is highly significant. They're not by accident.
No, there's nothing by accident, I said before. And I did an interview a while back with Richard D. Hall, and explained that the molecular angles of the molecules of water are actually the shape of a pyramid. The molecular vibration traces a pyramid. And actually, it turns out that the Giza Pyramid is actually that particular water harmonic.
Yes, and it's also not surprising to know that if one takes a grain of sand and looks at the structure of that, the atomic structure of it, that's the form of it is in structure. Is mirrored in the angular form of the pyramid itself. In other words, that what it's made up with mirrors what it looks like in its complete form.
And what it is. That's the point, because we are bags of water. So therefore, we resonate at the water frequency when we go into the pyramids, which is why they don't want you meditating or, you know, being at peace within there, because you resonate with the frequencies of that energy field.
Mm. I tell you this, though, when it gets set off, when it starts going off, the wow factor is multiplied by tens. It is so astonishing. It's just mind-blowing. Even though you're expecting, or you know, you've got an idea and so on, it is just absolutely crazy how loud it is, you know, to the point where, I mean, as I was laying there, I mean, I felt the pressure on my skin. I could feel the pressure on my skin. I thought my eardrums were going to pop, and I thought I'd have to stop. but it persisted until we were finally halted by guns.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's all about keeping all of this hidden from you at any gunpoint or at any price. The simple, you know, information of it is if we understood all the harmonics and we understood the things inside the pyramids that they've been pillaging and, you know, taking away, stealing, we'd get it. We'd see that. We'd go, you know, we'd finally understand it. But what you see, what the controllers want basically is to stop all of this information so we don't become conscious. And if we become conscious, we understand how to defeat the control system with ease. And again, the pyramids, the information, the evidences and proofs that are contained in there, they do not want you getting hold of, because they spent thousands and thousands of years building this construct all around us to keep the human species in check.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I believe that that's the reason, the real reason at a higher level, higher mundane level, why those six men were hideously killed underground in the village just next to where we stayed. Still leaves a bad taste, that whole business. But, you know, there are those out there who know exactly what they're... I just watched a video that a good friend of ours, Howard Middleton Jones, passed on to us. Which shows a sort of, and it's an American video, YouTube video, sort of covering bases on what's happened to antiquity since the revolution. And they interviewed Zahi on it, so it was obviously before he went. And in it, he was being interviewed right by the village, by where the house was brought down, house number 13, which is significant to me because I was born 13th minute, 13th hour, Friday 13th, October 1950. And 13's followed me all through life, and 3333 is Judith's as well. We link together in that. But in any event, house number 13 is right next door to where we stayed, where these men did the illegal excavation. And in this recent YouTube that I just watched, he's saying, you know, yes, the houses, they collapsed into this illegal dig and killed the men underneath. What absolute nonsense. We got the photographs to prove it. I've been inside the house with Judith taking photographs. You know, we've got the photographs, you know, showing it. We've been up inside, you know, with all the cracks where we know exactly what happened there. And they weren't killed because the house collapsed on them. That was taken down afterwards, bit by bit by bit by bit, until most of House 13 was demolished because it was attracting too much attention. And underneath it all, you know, the men died when the digger that was there could have got them out in a couple of hours. No, they were sacrificed.
So, yeah, absolutely. This is what they...
And since then, I'll just add in, Tony, since then, we've acquired through legal means, I have to say, through our friend... another friend, Bill, official photographs that were taken down in the chambers where these men were, where the bloodstained clothes and everything is still lying in there. And, you know, if there was a collapse, it must have been selective because there was still space in there. They were actually backfilling with shovels, earth and so on, to try and fill these chambers to disguise what was left of the guys. But there was still space in there. But in recent times, in the last week or two, in fact, I started taking a look at those photographs with a view to searching for images. And sure enough, there they were. Just the same as in NC2. Just the same as it throughout the Great Pyramid. Just the same as at the bottom of the Osiris shaft and up in the shaft itself. Just the same as underneath and underground of the solar cross. Just the same as at the Sun Temple of Abu Ghurab. Just the same as at an ancient site locally here to us, would you believe? So, you know, I say to everybody, go figure. Keep this alive, because if there's people going in there to officially excavate, brilliant. It needs it. It needs a professional excavation. But we say that non-invasively, a photo-archaeological survey could be conducted first. That would not touch a thing, and it would bring the information out before anything is touched, before any excavation is done. We have not touched a thing in there. We have not so much as moved a thing. We've just been in there to record. and we believe that a survey could be done of the type that we describe before anything else is done, because whoever goes in there, they will have the keys to possibly the greatest secrets that is waiting to see the light of modern day. They are the walls of record, the walls of record, and they need to be brought out for the world, not for the few. And we beg and pray. I mean, it's the one reason we're pushing like crazy the book, because that is the final message in the book. Look, this is the main thing that we're finding, and it cross-relates to other sites and everything. There are records there that record the time and have got information. For God's sake, let's have those out. Let's have proper equipment to photograph in all of these places. If just one photograph in the thousands that we've got and we've already examined, if just one single photograph proves that what we're saying is completely true, one photograph, then that is sufficient for the entire operation to mobilize and put in a professional photo-archaeological team to investigate it before the world. And let that be done before any sand or anything is scratched from the surface. And that's what we're begging for, and that's what we want the exposure for them to do that, and for everybody to be watching, everybody to be looking, everybody to ask questions. Everybody, please, please, please. You know, we want people to come to the site to go through this and to test it themselves. We put 100 photographs on there still from the original visit down in there, 100 high-definition photographs. People can download off our site for free. We'll yield them up. We've offered our whole portfolio to the authorities. We've never been recontacted. You know, we're offering it out to everybody else. We're saying, don't take our word for it. If it's true, it'll stand its own test, and we believe it will. So we're throwing it out to everybody. You know, richardgabriel.info, and the actual site for the book, Echoes from the Chamber, is echoesfromthechamber.info. So you've got two sites, and you can get to one or the other from both. And, of course, the Giza Foundation is our foundation to encompass all of this, and in particular our campaign to do something about the dreadful, tragic animal situation that's playing itself out there. It's almost like an animal genocide if there's such a thing. So there's the GizaFoundation.org as well. So there you go.
Yeah, excellent information. Have you got any comments on that, Rav? As I say, I mean, basically, it's all to cover up the truth. And on this show, we go straight to the throat of the truth and bring it out there. And are you in a position to comment there, Rav?
Well, yeah, I had a couple of things I wanted to mention. Are you familiar with the Tomb of the Visitor? Was one. And then also, you know, you have to think, you know, for years, Zahi Hawass was saying, you know, there's no tunnels under the pyramids. There's no tunnels under the pyramids. And then they discover the Osiris tomb under the Great Pyramid in that part of the plateau. And then, you know, you have in the histories where it talks about this, there's the skyway and the waterway. And one of them was supposed to be where you could take a boat through these tunnels underground that were, you know, half filled with water. And then, you know, there's all kinds of other stuff talking about tunnels and things under the plateau. But one of the main ones I wanted to mention here is the Sphinx. You know, Edgar Cayce, everybody knows Edgar Cayce, talked about the Hall of Records under the paw of the Sphinx. Well, you know, I know they found the stairway leading down. I know that they started excavating, but what else, what have they found? Did they, what, a bare room? Really, seriously? We know that they continually lie about what they're finding. I mean, like you said, we literally need someone privately to go in there and just use, like, some company just came up with a 150 megapixel camera.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's get one of these super cameras and go down there and literally, like you said, photograph every square foot and see what we get. You know?
Exactly, yes.
And they're everywhere. The tunnels are all over the world.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah,
that's absolutely true. Yes, yes. I mean, we're going to put whatever we get. I mean, we commit everything. We live very, very simply, both Judith and I, just covering out of our own money our expenses to get to each other and get over there. Our friends over there, we live very, very, very basically and simply. If we're out in the desert, it's on the sand or in the caves of the monks. And we've got friends who help us in very sort of reduced circumstances. in Giza, so it doesn't cost a lot to actually stay there. Everything spare that we got, we put into this, either to do the animal rescue work or do our exploration work. And when we go over this time, although the Giza Foundation is a legal entity registered here, it will be registered actually in Giza also, and that will help us tremendously. And, you know, we're putting all the resources to that, including anything, any of the paltry amount that will come back from the book. But, you know, any support anybody can give us, you know, we look for it as everybody does. But that's what we're doing with anything that comes to us, any money that comes to us, it goes to that. And I will say publicly now, if I don't know whether this will reach any of the ears of those who've been so kind as to give what small amounts they're able to help us. But if anybody's out there listening, I from the bottom of our hearts, we thank you. And we're quite sincere and genuine that it is going to this purpose, totally to this purpose. If we generate sufficient funds, if we find a patron, it will go to do exactly what you've just described, to investigate, to do our animal work truly, but to investigate also places that aren't closed, because all these things are hidden in plain sight in places where thousands of tourists go. All you've got to do is look for ancient surfaces that are perhaps a little bit more protected, under surfaces, ceilings, roofs, and so on, where any images are less likely to have received wear and tear and erosion and so on. You know, we pray to our minders and others to help facilitate it. Our intent will be to see this out to whatever fulfillment we're meant to do together in this life within our birth plan. We go over there expecting, hoping for everything, but expecting nothing and letting it go, because we know that we're always given to go to the right place, to do the right thing. People appear to us complete strangers, but they know us completely. They say, I've been waiting for you, or they say, come, I have something to show you. They take us. We know that this is right. We go, and the wow factor hits us like a tornado, and we calm ourselves and just go with the flow of it. We record what we have to record. We come back, and then we share it with the public. That's what's meant to happen. And we just want people to come in their droves, test it themselves, and then jump on the bandwagon, jump on the journey. Join us with it. As you're doing, Tony, exactly as you're doing.
Exactly. That's the point. You've got to go and when you throw caution to the wind to a degree, you just go with it and you just resonate with what feels right to you. And, you know, you have to learn to do that in order to take on this journey, especially to the degree that yourself, Richard, and many others like you are doing. You need to just go with it and trust that everything's going to manifest at the right time, at the right place, and give you the right information.
Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon. I cut in on you there.
No, that's fine. Carry on.
How about this for a synchronicity, right? Just recently, we picked up on a YouTube. Again, it was referred to us by a friend. It was Howard, in fact, again. He said, I think you'd be interested to see this. I can't quote the details of it, but you can search this and find it. And it referred to the so-called air shafts in the pyramid. In particular, it referred to the southern air shaft from the Queen's Chamber, which leads up to, along at the end of its depth or its height, to what has been colloquially known as Gantenbrink's door. And Gantenbrink is a researcher who was allowed under license to design and bring in the first robot that would go up through this 8-inch square shaft and negotiate its twists and turns and go up to the top and see what was there. And he photographed the barrier, the doorway with the copper handles on it. It continued before he was finally blown off the site, as so many are when they find something and go official with it. Before that, they drilled a hole through that front door, put a fiber optic camera through to take pictures and have a look. They found a second door just a little way further in. To date, we don't know whether they breached that door, but in any event, the composite photographs that they took inside there showed a couple of red patinaed glyphs, which sparked huge controversy. But in any event, this researcher, and I apologize to him, I can't draw his name to mind, he observed that from those pictures showing that first door, The pictures also showed in the frame part of the wall section and the ceiling section of this 8-inch tunnel tube shaft. And he noticed that there were sort of little divots, marks on the ceiling part of it. And it tweaked something in his brain as an astronomer. He said, hang on, that looks like the markings of a constellation I know, Draco. So he investigated further and he realized that the divots were a representation of Draco and its associated constellations and stars. So he extracted that and compared it to night sky, couldn't find anything like a match. So he used sophisticated software and he played the heavens back through time, back through precessionary time. And he found an exact match to the configuration of that layout on the roof part of the shaft. And it dated 9,200 years BC, 11,200 years ago. So immediately that sort of knocks on the head all the authoritative supposition that it was only a few thousand years ago that it was built. So he proposes, of course, you know, the builders had to have put that in place when they built it. That takes it back to that time. But when I looked at these pictures, that was fascinating. I thought, yeah, right, good for you. But when I looked at them, I wasn't looking at divots. I was looking for images. So I put I gathered all the frames that I could find on the internet into a folder, and I systematically started going through them, laboriously putting each one through this photographic analysis technique. And it sounds grander than it is, but I analyzed them, and sure as hell, on that back wall with the copper handles, there's a whole scene in perspective there. There's buildings, an archway building, a line of buildings across the back, like a causeway. There's pyramids, there's people, there's faces, there's all sorts. On the left-hand wall, there's other figures. On the right-hand wall, there's like almost like a death mask. There's a huge mask. That was at the extreme of the delineation that I could do on it, but nonetheless, I did manage to pull it out. So then I turned my attention to the composite pictures that they got when they put the fiber optic through that first door, in between that and the second door. And guess what? The surfaces are covered in images as well. And another thing is a part of this technique that we noticed all the way through, all wherever these images are, that it isn't just like, you imagine, just imagine, for instance, let's say, let's just pick something out. I don't know. Let's think of a mammal, because there's loads of mammals in there as well. Let's pick a dolphin. Let's say you've got a picture of a dolphin imprinted to a wall surface. Let's say that when you look at it through your analysis, it shows itself as a holographic image of a dolphin. But when you look at it a bit closer and change the focal depth, you find that the actual shape of the dolphin is made up of hundreds and hundreds of smaller little animals that follow within the contours of the shape. So as we've sort of aptly named this, a technique everywhere is used, which we've called fractal imaging. So you find this fractal imaging, and I found it on the air shaft just the same as this fractal imaging. So there you go. We've got a time date stamp of 11,200 plus. We've got this imaging going in there as well. These walls of record even continue there. You couldn't make it up if you tried. It's there. And I say to people, hey, I've put some of the pictures on already. I'm going to put more on. Go try it for yourself. And I have to say to people also that when you look at these things, it's not like looking at a Picasso on the wall or a Rembrandt. You have to look at these surfaces, and it's like those old-fashioned, two or three decades ago, where there was all the rage, these pixelated magic pictures. They were sort of abstracts. And if you defocused your eyes, a picture would pop out at you. I remember getting these, and I couldn't get it. I couldn't make it work. I was very frustrated with it because everybody was seeing these pictures, and I'd almost given up that it was a spoof. But I was sitting at home. I bought one of those pictures and we had it on the wall because it was just a very nice abstract, pixelated abstract. And I was sitting there one night in the chair just daydreaming, and I had to look at the picture in a daydreamy state, not even trying. And my sort of eyes went dreamy, out of focus, and boom, I thought, my God, look at that. And suddenly it wasn't a pixelated abstract. It was a full-blown picture. I got it. Now, these are the same. you can look at these, and this has happened with lots and lots of people I've asked to look at them. If I had them sat beside me, I could do the focus and defocus, and you get it instantly. But when you're looking at the static picture on the screen, you have to do the same thing. You have to try and defuse your eyes and go into the surface. And when you get it the first time, suddenly it'll pop into place for all the pictures, all of them. You'll suddenly realize how you've got to go about looking at this. You look for where eyes are more prominent, or a nose or a mouth is more prominent. Then defocus, you get the depth of perspective, and then suddenly you can get the whole picture. And you mentioned the Sphinx back along. Well, think of the tie-up. Again, it's all stuff that's been swept under the carpet. Think about the Osiris shaft. Now, we know that when that was drained, I had a great laugh, because I was looking at one of the pictures, the official pictures at the time, that shows Zahi sitting in the bottom of the Osiris shaft, 110 foot plus down below, where they'd lifted the lid on the huge sarcophagus down there. And he was sitting on the rock there posing, and the photographs captured him. The water had been drained at that stage, or most of it. And I put that one under scrutiny. I laughed at it, because right beside him on the rock's covered in images. And there's other images in there that I've shown as well, you know, and I've sort of put the header on the site saying, you know, I wonder if he realized what was on the rock beside him. But in any event, of course, we know that there was GPR carried out when that water was drained. And of course, it's been all hushed up. But there was a tunnel found underneath. There's a tunnel running underneath. It's part of the network. That tunnel links up, and it was going down in a direction to the tunnel that's been denied coming from the back end of the Sphinx. The whole thing, of course, is a link up. You know, even the NC2 system, it's got to be linked up, because that originally, in its original state, was one of the deep earth fissures that was carved out by water when it was some hundreds of feet higher than it is now. Came up to the surface of the edge of the pyramids at the end of the last ice melt, but it was a lot deeper than that on a previous occasion. And it was reamed out at that time, along with the other deep earth fissures that go miles down into the ground. And the cave of the birds, or the cave of the bats, that one is able to go into before getting into the main tunnel system, that was obviously hewn out later. They were hewn from fissures, we believe, quite clearly, that were already in place. They were just enlarged and turned into tomb chambers later. But the original, where you enter into it now at the moment from the back of the front tomb, that is still the disrupted cave and cavern system that runs down to the blockage 150 feet at the tube tunnel. So, you know, there's tons and tons and tons. It's all there in plain sight, but it's all being suppressed. The audit trail has got to be suppressed. Otherwise, why would they not wish to make this public?
Okay, that was great emphasis, but I couldn't hear what you were saying because you were wrapping something there. Sorry.
Passion's coming again. Say, why would they not wish to make this public? Otherwise,
because they can't control us if they tell us the truth.
Precisely.
Yep. Precisely.
And they want to get their hands to any technology that's down there.
Absolutely. Well, and I wanted to mention, you know, there was a story that came out that after the discovery of Gantenbrink's door, shortly after that, they closed off access to the King's Chamber and the Relieving Chambers, mainly the Relieving Chambers, and they basically, it sounded like they were excavating through the pyramid to try to access the chamber that was beyond the door. And, of course, they said, oh, no, we're not doing any such thing. But that's just what they do. I mean, if they get a hint of anything being there, somebody goes in to get it, and then they're like, oh, yep, okay, well, we found a chamber, but there's nothing here. Right.
Yep, they closed the audit trail. That's absolutely what happens. You know, you need to see...
And Zahi Hawass was a tool. I mean, honestly, I'm sorry. You know, yep. he was bought and paid for. He was a tool.
Agreed.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, it's the same old story yet again. The point is, I know as well, you see, the thing is that we left those things there for us to find later on in the future.
That's right.
This is my take on it.
Yeah, that's it.
And it was simply because the human race was going into unconsciousness at a deep, 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 deep level. So the ones that actually got away with the technology that have had it all this time are actually out there still running the planet to this day and keeping away from us free energy, anti-gravity, healing, extended life, technologies, incredible stuff. And, you know, this is what's going on, but now we're returning back to full consciousness again and we're realizing and waking up to the truth that we've been controlled all along. And that's what we need to do. And the way to do that, as it explains, is become conscious of all the aspects. You know, conscious of all the cures that we've got and conscious of the whole situation and the control grid. And it's the only way we can do it. So, you know, if we end up with actual proof out of the pyramids that who we are and what went on and why it all went on, then the people will be at the top, basically. The eyes of the pyramid will be exposed. And then there'll be nowhere for them to hide because we'll have the technology as well. So they're scrambling like anything to prevent us from growing or coming to full consciousness. Because this is not the first time they've done this thing. They did it with the Incas, the Aztecs, the Mayans. You know, they've been doing it for a very, very long time. It's farming, basically, the human race.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, here's an example. I mean, you can go all the way back into, like, the 1500s, the 1400s, 12th century, you know, as far back as you want to go, the people in control would go and find the treasures of the previous ages, and an example is the ever-burning lamps, you know, and what happened to them. They would go and they would find where these lamps were, and of course they would take the treasure for themselves, but they would put out the lamp and then try to relight it and be like, well, why can't we relight it? You know? I mean, there's always been technology that certain people have had that others haven't. And there's a group that wants all of it. They want everything. So, yeah.
And yeah, again, it's all control because, you know, if we are in need of food, if we're in need of energy, if we're in need of anything, we're in a position of a decreased reliance on someone or something else. And so it's like, giving people a breadcrumbs instead of a loaf. There's one breadcrumb at a time. If this guy's following you and he's hungry, he wants you to give him a breadcrumb. So therefore, he wants something from you in return. And that's what this whole system is based on, lack and scarcity.
Extinction economy. It's like exactly what is going on with the bluefin tuna. The people that 5 years ago bought these, you know, 900, 1,000, you know, whatever pound tunas and stuck them in a freezer and, you know, paid $200,000 for them, you know, in 5 years when there are no tuna because they're going to die from the radiation coming from Fukushima. They're going to pull these tuna out of their locker and they're going to think they're going to sell it for like $1 million or $2 million. You know, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, they're literally trying to, and with us too, they're going to kill off everybody that they can't certifiably own outright except for themselves. I mean, they're animals, plants, look at Monsanto. Monsanto's motto is nothing shall grow that we don't own. I mean, that is simply abhorrent.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
There's no other word for it.
Yeah, and it's a Luciferian, and that's unfortunately, you know, the mentality of the psychopaths that are running this whole show. They're purely, you know, purely Luciferian, and by hook or by crook, they want to maintain control. And that's obviously the opposite to what we need to do, folks.
Well, remember the story of King Canute. When you take into account what's happening on a cosmic scale, a grand cosmic scale, I think maybe it's going to be a Canute situation as far as what they're trying to do.
Just remind us and the listeners what the Canute situation is, please, Richard.
Yeah, where he tried to hold back the waters of the sea. I think perhaps that is the case now. All these people who I agree have been in control in the background all this time, they misjudge the power, I believe, of an inevitable situation. They could perhaps delay it a little bit, but the cosmic changes that are taking place, that are revealing themselves in every ivory tower, in every structure, in every vibrational entity, every planet in our system. They're all showing colossal changes, and it's all part of this cosmic sea of change, of vibration, that is going to overwhelm everything in a minute. And you're either awake to it and you're with it, or you're going to drown with it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there's a race, and it's the biggest story in human history. It's the hidden story of mankind. And, I look forward to a day when all of these restrictions just are going to be lifted, and Pandora's boxes, the lid comes off, because, my God, it's going to be beautiful. It's going to be absolutely beautiful. Most people couldn't even imagine, the incredible realities out there in deep space and other cultures, other civilizations. And yes, get over it, aliens. But it's going to be incredible. Again, consciousness, we need to get to the point where we kick in with the 100th monkey, I say, every week, where enough people are conscious, and it just affects everybody around you, and they start becoming conscious too. And that's the day that's going to be a joyous day, that.
Yes, I agree. When you just get a hint of the power of these, that's there waiting to come in from this other source, from the greater source, it's totally humbling and exhilarating at the same time. We've had several things, and I'm sort of picking my mind to try and recall one that might be appropriate, but one sort of jumps forward, where Judith and I went to visit a very, very high-spirited elder who's no longer with us now, only in spirit, and we were invited into his home. And as we walked through the front door, we noticed outside that, although he didn't understand actually at the time, he'd had an iron gate fitted to the front of the building, and the patterning of the gate mirrored the flower of life pattern. And also, there was something in iron that had been fitted at the top, which was a pine cone, which of course mirrors the hypothalamus. And, we commented on it, what an incredible thing to walk past as we came in through his entrance. And, we sort of talked about that for a few minutes. But when we walked in, he walked ahead of us a few yards. And as we both walked in, there was a very, very large, open sort of hallway, stone hallway, that had one of these oriental type sort of carpets, rugs on it, a very big one. And I can only speak in the first person singular for myself, but Judith and I shared this. She felt it immediately also. As we walked in and took a couple of paces on to the area that was covered by the carpet, I immediately felt that it felt like when you're at the fairground and the wind is blown up underneath, these silly fairground things that blows your clothes up in the air from below. But it wasn't wind, it was energy. It was tangible. You could feel it. It was the most powerful. It was like a hurricane of energy suddenly hitting from below ground, coming up through. To the point, I with Judith, she also just knocked her off her legs, were knocked to the ground. And I was immediately emotionally overcome. Within myself, my God. And I remember mumbling, my God, Judith, you feel it. And she was going, yes. And we're just gasping with the effect of it. It was just absolutely overwhelming, tremendous. And I remember saying to Judith, go with it, Judith. And I fell back into myself, closed my eyes to it, and sort of raised with the energy. And then started to see pictures open out of my mind. And it was like the ground, although my eyes were closed, it was like the ground beneath my feet had become transparent or translucent, and I could see through. So a large dome of rock, and over on the far side of where the room would be, there was stairs leading down that went under this, almost like a mushroom of rock, and the stairs sort of went down in a spiral beneath it. until they came to running water, and there was a large pool at the bottom. But this was active, turbulent, active water. The water in its circulation as it was passing through underneath a stone ledge and going further under a stone ledge was swirling in this pool like a whirlpool, a rapid whirlpool. And I took my presence, if you like. I was aware of my presence standing at the edge, on the ledge at the edge of this pool, absolutely fascinated by it, because it seemed as if there was a mist over it, but it wasn't, it was like an energy mist rather than a water mist, but as fine as that. And I felt compulsed to it, felt drawn to it so powerfully, felt like I couldn't stop myself. I was being pulled towards it. And I felt myself falling forward, and it's that sort of inevitability where you think yourself, you know, it's like if you go to hit your hand with a hammer or something, you know, you're halfway there and you realize you're going to hit, you can't pull back, and you know it's going to happen, but you can't do anything to do it. It's about it, it's going to happen. Well, in this case, I was falling forward into this pool, and I was completely aware of myself, just out of body aware of myself. And I was waiting for the sensation of water as I hit the thing. And in my mind, I was thinking to myself, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? I'm going to feel water. And everything condenses in that split second. All these thoughts go through your head. And as I fell forward, at the moment of waiting for the sensation of water, as I passed through the sort of membrane of the surface of this pool, I found myself pop. It was like pop out the other side. And instead, I was floating in space. I was just floating in space, and I was seeing planets and stars and constellations and things. I was actually seeing what space shows you, you know, whether it defies physics or whatever. You know, I'm just describing it as I saw it. Now, back in the thing, I was aware back in the pool, in that room, that on the other side of the pool, there was like an entrance to a tunnel. It was carved in a tunnel. I could see it going straight. I couldn't see where it went because it was in darkness going down through. But there was like a glow in the air in the room that I was in, this pool room, the tunnel went off from it. Now, I know the direction that that would have been headed. But in any event, as I was within the experience of floating out to the atmosphere, I got to the point that I dread, which happens practically every time when I'm having one of these experiences, where a sort of excitement builds within you, where the experience almost becomes overwhelming, and the awareness of self builds within you, and you know that by doing so, you're dropping your vibration, you're pulling back to yourself, you're becoming too much engrossed with self, and your vibration drops. And you know, like in that split instant, you, oh, damn. And because you know you're pulling yourself back. And in an instant, boom, I was completely, my eyes opened, and I was aware of myself again on the rug next to Judith. And Judith was gasping, did you see that? Did you see that? And we stood up from there when our host came into the room. And how much he knew, I don't know. How much he'd seen, we didn't know at the time. And he led us through. He said, it's okay. And we were full of apologies, tears streaming down our faces, completely, totally overwhelmed and overcome by it. And he said, it's okay. He was very calm. It's okay. Come through. He said, Richard, I want you to sit there, please. Sit there. He was very particular. And Judith sat just beside me. And I said, I can only tell you with honesty what has just happened. And I tried as accurately as I could to describe, and then Judith described her version of it. And he said, I want to tell you, he said, and he named, I'm not going to name drop now, but there were particular significant others. He said that he had been told by others, and I'm talking, there's three names that come straight to mind, but he mentioned one or two others, who had described something that wasn't dissimilar, and had sat in the same seat I was sitting in and described the same things that I've been describing. He said, now I am convinced that we must investigate this further. I've resisted up until now, but now I believe that I must do this. Now, we learned later of his passing before we returned the following year. But in that time, we learned that he'd authorized for GPR to be brought in, and this house was surveyed. In the area where we'd had the experience, the GPR picked up a dome of rock, stairs leading down, water, fast-flowing water, a large body of water, and a tunnel leading off to where we know that there is a, we already know categorically that there is a buried temple on the plateau in line with where that tunnel was leading off to. We already knew, incidentally, that the person that I'm talking about was his family are one of the keeper families in the village. I'm talking about ancient keepers. They are guardians of the site that their family has occupied for since the, one of the first buildings that were put up there.
Interesting.
There you go.
Yeah, interesting. Again, you mentioned all the key things there with the aquifers, the running water, the energy alignments, the dome especially. This is why the Muslims have domes on their mosques, because all of these things have been hidden. They're hidden in plain sight. And, you know, all these geometric shapes have energy collection and magnification abilities, and this is exactly what you're describing. You had an energetic experience whilst in an energetic place.
Yeah, which can be found all over the world, all over Britain.
Yeah, all over the place. But yeah, Sandy's sat ever so quietly, so I don't know if you want to comment on anything you've heard, Spirit Dancer.
Yes, there's a couple things. About 4 years ago, I had about 6 months of visions and dreams about hieroglyphic things that had to do with pyramids. And so what he's talking about is very interesting to me, because I there is some connection there, and I can't tell you what it is other than, I mean, I've never been to the pyramids. I've never seen any of this stuff. And this one friend who had, I was describing some of these things that I was seeing, and, you know, some of these hieroglyphics I was seeing and being told what they meant and things like that. So it's very interesting to me. I'd love to see it. It'd be something that would be pretty exciting to go get to experience. And so, yeah, that's my comment. I was listening intently to everything you said. It's just fun to hear about it. I'm going to send some energy specifically to see if we can't get that opened up so that the world can see what's in there, because that's one of the things that I get to do on my fourth dimension is work with energy. So to open things up when things are shut down. So that's already in my plan since I heard what you had to say today. So that's my comment.
Cool. I understand from Richard as well that there's another expedition being planned whereby members of the public can sign up for a trip with Richard as, I don't know what tour guide, I suppose is the correct term. So details for us on that one, Richard.
Well, yeah, I mean, all I would say to you, this is something that we've always wished to do and wanted to plan. I mean, it's all really through the auspices of the Giza Foundation. You know, we've got to put our ducks in order first. You know, we're seeking support now that the book is out there. We're hoping that will convey the message and bring a little bit more help to us and bring more friends in. And following that, you know, we will look to guide ourselves. We have got infrastructure in place over there with friends that we have, and we'll be looking to take that a step further forward to fruition when we're over there this time again. You know, in the not too distant future.
Yeah, it'd be good to get one of those megapixel cameras that Rav was talking about.
Oh my goodness, yes. Oh, most certainly, yes. You know, to be able to use decent camera equipment. I mean, ours is pretty basic. You know, we need better equipment, and, you know, we need photographic experts. As I say, you know, we don't want our word just to be the final word. We want other people to test it also, better experts to test it, and with the right equipment. You know, we know where to go to. We know where to take people. We know where to show people. We know where the equipment needs to be placed. We know who to speak to in authority, who is friendly, and who can help us. So, you know, we're just looking for it all to be put together.
Yeah, again, it's amazing how heavily you have to rely on donations, isn't it? You know, to do the proper job that we're supposed to be doing, and being strapped for cash as we are, it's incredible that it's all panned out that way. But yeah, if, again, donations are critical, people, for doing the work that we're trying to do here. So everything's received graciously.
Yeah, absolutely. For all of us, it's crucial. You know, we just keep our faith, you know, that everything will be enabled as it's meant to. But we beg for it, you know, but not just as a sort of open hand. It is coupled with the invitation, you know, the heartfelt invitation to people to take the sites apart, go to the material that we're offering. You know, we're sharing everything, and we're sitting on. I mean, we just scratched the surface. We're sitting on. I mean, Judith on her side, she's got thousands and thousands. She's so good with a camera, and she's got so many pictures as well that we've got to examine, and other reports and information of experiences and so on. We just haven't got the time. I mean, I keep myself going with my day job, my mundane job, and Judith also her side, and that occupies time. If you've got the money, you make time, because you would be on this full time, and we're unable to do that. So, you know, we're doing it not just for ourselves, but we're doing it in pursuit of our driven intention, our birth plan, if you like, but it's with the overriding intention to share everything with everybody, to pull everybody in together on it, to open it up to everybody as it should be. This belongs to everybody. This is knowledge that belongs to everybody, that has been stolen from everybody's consciousness, suppressed from everybody's consciousness. And, you know, if what we're doing simply unlocks a key to awareness or a route for people, other people to go and test, then by God, we've done our job. We got a lot more planned, and we're sitting on a lot more. And, you know, as the power allows us, it'll all be come out. We'll share the lot. So, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, well, it's all unfolding step by step by step. And, you know, we'll see, like you said, where it goes. It is the biggest story in the history of the human race. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of surprises for people on many different levels. You got any comments on that one, Rev?
Oh, my God, where do I begin? Yeah. The one way that you might be able to, well, I mean, if you go, like, say, National Geographic Society or something like that, I mean, there's a possibility, but then you got to deal with all the corporate crap, you know? I mean, if you can just find, like, you know, one or two people that are willing to, you know, donate some equipment and a little bit of funds, you know, you're on your way. I mean, that's really all it takes, is to get this rolling. And once you've got a little more proof, I mean, I think it's pretty much indisputable that what you're saying is the truth now. But if you can get a little bit of verification, I mean, how do you refute that? You can take the same picture, do the exact same thing, and get the same results, you know?
Yep, that's right. It just needs to be done with proper camera equipment and also pose, because I say again that everything so far that we've discovered has been from incidental photographs, not ones that we, you know, who goes to a country like Egypt with a purpose of photographing sections of wall, you see?
Right.
Well, that's precisely what's got to be done now. We know, go there, look, photograph that wall section, go to that tomb and photograph the walls in there. Go up into the pyramid and photograph there, there, and there. Even if you've got to pay money to actually be allowed to take photographs, because nobody's going to think anything of you taking a photograph. You know, okay, you've got a fancy camera with you, but what the heck? If they've got their backsheesh in their pocket or you've paid officially for it, it's worth it. You know, you need that money to be able to do it, because that's the system. But if you're able to do that and make a donation to the official organization of the plateau or whatever, then fine. You know, do it by the right means. There's no need to do it below the radar. One can pay the money, get the license, show that you're non-invasive. You come back and then you're able to analyze it and have laboratories analyze it. And that's where you get your convincing validations from.
Well, and that's the other thing is, I mean, we don't have to go in and do what, you know, Mascheroni did or what, you know, well, what was it, Cavigliari or what was his name?
Yes, Sultan Caviglia, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, going in and breaking down walls and digging holes and doing all this. We don't need to do that.
No, nope,
I mean, we have the technology that, I mean, we have cameras that can literally see through walls. You know, mm-hmm. We have the technology to do this stuff. You know, it's out there. It's just not available to the public necessarily. I wouldn't be surprised if they've already got holographic imaging of everything that's on the Giza Plateau stored in some 3D, you know, holographic image, you know, somewhere that they took from satellite. Because that's the extent of the technology that we, or they, have access to.
Exactly.
You know, they can see up to, like 500 or 600 feet underground and a couple of thousand feet underwater.
They've actually mapped the inner Earth, Raph, and they've shown all the oceans of the inner Earth. So,
well, yeah,
yes,
I mean, yeah, it's all out there. Yeah.
So, you know, I guess we're relying once again on the one listener out there, and perhaps one or two others. you know, go to it, friends.
Yep, this is it. It's the main thing. You know, it's the main backbone that we need. But, again, we've come to the same conclusion again with the technology's there. The technology's been there for thousands and thousands and thousands of years, if not a hell of a lot longer. They've always had it. And if that's the case, and they've been developing better and better and better technologies in all this time, you just imagine the extent of the technological abilities of this breakaway civilization of the human race. They will be so, so far ahead of us down here. It'll be incredible. And it'll stretch even, well, the information that I've got is it's beyond comprehension, what they've actually got. And that's bloody good information. So, you know, you've got to start stretching your minds. Never mind stretching your mind saying, oh, you know, the Vatican hiding stuff and, you know what I mean? That's nothing compared to what's reality out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, bring it on. Let's get consciousness rocking. And let's break down these walls and get going.
Yeah.
Have you ever tried a picture looking down one of the hallways or lengthwise down one of the chambers and see what you can pull up?
Well, I'll tell you what. Even before I came across that... YouTube report on the shaft. When we were last there, Judith was taking her batch and I was taking mine. Before we left the King's Chamber, we'd previously, on a previous visit in any case, following excavations that had been secretly taking place up above us in the chamber that we were aware of, we were aware that it had altered the frequency in there slightly. And that's the first thing. Also, you know, all the pictures that you see of the King's Chamber, they miss the little, when you step down through the, you know, you have to stoop down and walk through the opening into where those counterbalance stones were in the middle to get into the King's. But just before you step into that sort of tunneled part, on the right-hand side, there's a grilled doorway. Most people just pass it by. Oh, yeah, grill doorway, padlock on it. Mm-mm-mm-mm. Yeah, well, I've taken pictures through that grill into there. We haven't been inside there. Love to. But you can see at the back of that, it isn't modern. And there's steps going up through there. Now, I don't know whether those steps lead up to the chambers above the King's Chamber, between the lintels. Because in the past, we've always been led to understand that those were accessed from a ladder that had been tied at the side. And it was through excavations above the topmost part of the Grand Gallery that they gained access to them. But, you know, we puzzle every time. behind that grill door that you'll be hard-pressed to find a picture of that or an illustration or a reference to that anywhere. But it's there. It's, you know, people miss it. It's in plain, it's there. And there's images all on the walls in there, and that's ancient. That's ancient walls in there. So, you know, it goes with the original construction. But I defy anybody to come up with the research information on that. It doesn't exist as far as I can see, but it does.
Oh, it exists.
Sorry, Tony, is that not the same one that goes to the relieving chambers? Because, I mean, I know about that one.
That's the one I'm speculating, actually, Rob. That's the one I'm speculating. I speculated that it would go up to the properly called the relieving chambers. But I previously understood that they'd got access to the relieving chambers via a ladder that was strapped up the wall at the back end, the top end of the Grand Gallery. We know already from past whistleblowing that excavations, tunneling was going on from that ladder, from above that ladder. There was a loom of cabling went up there for a time. And I think Larry Hunter broke the story of it way ages and ages ago, where he got in there and saw the bags of chippings and so on from where they'd been tunneling up there during a period when it was supposed to have been being cleaned. So, yes, I mean, I would go with you, you know, that's what logic dictates. That was an original natural way up to those relieving chambers. But because it's padlocked with a tight grilled iron mesh door, who knows, a door that everybody walks past.
Well, I would speculate that it goes to meet up with the Gantenbrink door and chamber rather than just simply going to the relieving chambers, because the relieving chambers weren't finished. They were simply to relieve pressure on the King's Chamber for the resonance factor, in my opinion.
Yes, I mean, I'll buy that possibility as well. You know, I'd love to get behind that door.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there was a story, and I honestly, I'm sorry, I can't remember where I had read it, but someone who had done, you know, excavations and research at the pyramid, and this would have been in after World War I, I think, but before World War II. And they actually opened up a chamber in the pyramid through some type of a cantilevered or counterbalanced stone door, and they accessed clear metal or clear material that they could bend that wouldn't break, and a type of metal that wouldn't rust, and like some other things. And there's speculation that that's where some of the modern metallurgy came from, is them, you know, taking samples of this and figuring out what, you know, elements were in it. But there's too many stories to go into in, you know, 2 hours.
Yes, absolutely, yes. You know, and we go into the radiation hit that we know of down by the village and two other places, you know, which we think sort of breaks towards Stargate technology. But that's another story, and it would need more than a few minutes to talk about that. So, yes, I mean, I go with what you say. And I can't be specific myself either and say, yes, it was that report or that report. But I've got a memory in my mind of reading stuff about that as well, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's all tied. And I agree also that on a higher level, mundane higher level, that of course, they got to know about this. The only ace that we got up our sleeve that we're aware of, that Judith and I experienced firsthand ourselves down in the NC2 system, is, as we understand, that there are barriers. We felt personally to be absolutely safe and at home when we were down in there. But we also had the distinct impression that not everybody would, that others would feel very unwell at being in that vibration. And we're of the understanding that the deeper you go, the closer you go to wherever stuff is stashed in, when the people took to the underground and our ancestral off-planet folks, the ones that stay behind, went even deeper into airlocked sections, that those are protected by ever greater vibrational barriers. where by whatever control, God only knows, the vibrational presence of matter, of everything around you changes. And if you are unable to sustain that, then you will be harmed by it. Forget all this nonsense about booby traps or stand on that and a nail will hit you on the head or a... talking here about vibrational differences that are harmful to you unless you are able, through your development or whatever, able to sustain those changes in vibration. Think of it in terms, or I say to people, think of it in terms of radiation. You know, if you've got a natural radiation suit, then you're going to be okay. But if you ain't got that natural suit, then you're going to be harmed by it. And it's as simple as that.
I mean, I think I mentioned this before to you, Richard, that a lot of great people throughout history have tried to spend the night in the chambers. And one of, in particular that springs to mind is Napoleon. But he went in to try and spend a night in there, and he came running out screaming because what actually happens is the pyramid reflects what you take into it. So you take negative energy or negative information or negative things or fields in there, you're going to get the negative back, and that's going to scare the mother out of you.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we know, I mean, there's things I haven't spoken about. You know, it takes hours, and it brings in stuff that Judith needs to be talking about, or Bill needs to be talking about, other colleagues. But I'll give you an instance. I mean, we know of an excavation that was taking place on a, I'll inverted commas and say it, a hot site, a hot location, that we were aware of from GPR, that there was something that, a target that we were going for. A radioactive target, or it was given a radioactive effect on the findings of the GPR, and it ultimately had to be abandoned several meters down. The engineering was done very expertly, and it was officially sanctioned. But the reason it had to be abandoned was that all the expert people who were working on the dig were becoming ill when they went, as they descended, when they went past different levels, depths. And they said that it wasn't the air, they just were feeling ill. Vibrationally, it was getting to them. They couldn't sustain it. They couldn't work down there.
Yep.
And in the end, it had to be given up to a future, another occasion or another time when more thought was given to it. And for the time being, the whole thing was filled back to ground.
Yeah.
Just one little example.
Yeah, well, there's another interesting example, because when I met with Samas Ramovic, who's on the Bosnian pyramid dig, he had the opposite, whereby people were going into the tunnels underneath the actual pyramids, and the radiation there was healing them. And old wounds and old aches and old pains and diseases and all sorts of things that were they were sort of like falling down from previously, all started to vanish and started to feel better and better and better.
Yes, absolutely, yes. I mean, different properties, obviously, different vibrational properties. And it was, I read of that, it was wonderful to hear.
Yeah, this is it. It's all about harmonics. I mean, the whole world is all about harmonics. This is the point. Fractals, harmonics, geometry, etc. And they're all part of the one. I mean, people are running off studying physics there and science there and chemistry there, but nobody's pulling it all together because that's alchemy. And it's the alchemy that's the actual truth. What they need to do is split everything up into sections, and you study that bit, you study that bit, never the twain shall meet. But what you need to do is put them all together as a whole. This is what, you know, this is the whole point. Again, systems. Education.